It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strandchamps. Today, food for thought. Say we go out for brunch. You want bacon and sausage. I go for the tofu scramble. You order a decaf mochaccino soy latte. I don't know what that is. Taste can seem so incredibly individual, as though no two people could possibly share all the same likes and dislikes. But beyond individual taste buds, there are vast social and economic trends and even hidden tastemakers shaping the foods we eat. Like cupcakes. Remember how they used to come in two flavors, chocolate or vanilla, and they were served at children's birthday parties? And then, almost overnight, they were transformed into upscale, decadent desserts for grown-ups. How does that happen? Journalist David Sachs investigates in his book, The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes But Fed Up with Fondue. Sarah Nix caught up with him.
It seems like over the past 10 years, food has become the next great mark of cultural savvy. Do you have any idea why knowing about the next big food trend or the latest hot chef or the best fermentation recipe has become equivalent to, say, being in the loop about music or art or films?
Yeah. You know, my wife loves to say that food is our new culture, that chefs are our rock stars and our artists, and that's how we value things today. And I think it's for a couple reasons. One is that food and cooking went really since the mid-90s and the rise of the Food Network and became a form of entertainment. And I think it grew because it is accessible to everyone. You know, opera is something that's accessible to only people who really understand it and live in an area where there's opera and can kind of afford to go. Art is the same thing. You know, there's not a lot of art shows that people go to. It's not sort of the most accessible form of culture to the masses. And the other forms of culture have been kind of devalued, right? Music is now something you just get whenever you want, however you want. And there's no real challenge to it. You just download billions of songs at the touch of a finger. Same with film and television and movies. But, you know, food still requires an effort. You have to go and pay an amount of money to get it. You can't just click and get it for free. It's an analog form of culture and remains so. You can't digitize food. So you could talk about it and share it virally, but it's still a very human experience. And because of that, you know, everybody has access to it in some way, whether it's people talking about cupcakes and sharing recipes about them or someone going to Alinea or some really fancy restaurant in Chicago and paying $300 for dinner and discussing that and posting photos of it and, you know, critiques of it on Yelp or whatever.
It's fascinating to me how sticky these trends are, these fads are. You know, I heard a couple of years ago about this bone luge thing where you scoop the marrow out of a roasted beef shank bone and then you pour port. You drink the port from the scooped out bone. And it seemed completely absurd. But of course, I went and did it anyhow. I mean, why do you think they're so attractive sometimes, these trends?
I mean, the ones that are attractive and the ones that have sort of staying power do so because they're good. They taste good, or like the bone luge, they're fun. You know, I think there's something to be said about the benefits that these things give. You know, the fact is, like, the food truck trend, which isn't a food but sort of a business model that in itself is a food trend, it hasn't just flashed in the pan and gone away because it provides a benefit for people opening food trucks that opening a restaurant doesn't. It's less expensive. It's mobile. They can test out new concepts. They're not tied down to a lease. They're not tied down to a brick and mortar location. And then for people dining there, you know, the food comes to them. There's a sense of excitement and conspicuous consumption, but there's also, it's a quicker, easier option to get lunch when you work in an office in a certain area than having to go and drive to a restaurant and sit down. And that advantage is kind of built into it. And that is the case for almost all food trends that tend to be sort of longer lasting ones rather than fads of the season.
You know, it's fascinating to me. There are clearly these fads that, like the bone luge, come out of nowhere and seem kind of ridiculous, but have a short lifespan. Others stick for a really long time. And some that seem really obvious never take off. Like, your chapter about Indian food was fascinating.
Yeah. Trends can kind of be on the uptick for a long period of time. And only when the conditions are right do they really emerge and grow into something that's national or international. Indian food's a great example. There have been people that have been trying to make it into sort of a national food trend, something like Mexican food in the way that it's really just a part of our diet, or Chinese food, for the better part of half a century. And people in the food business have been betting on this and predicting it and saying, you know, 1984 is going to be the year of Indian food, and it hasn't happened yet. It requires a combination of different factors, from, you know, immigration rates to cultural factors, like, are there movies about India? Are people traveling to India? Do we know the names of Indian movie stars or Indian American movie stars? Are there these cultural figures or foods that we're familiar with? Are there foods from other cultures, like Sriracha hot sauce and Thai food, which are close enough that they can kind of serve as an entry point to something like Indian food? All these need to be in place, and something needs to happen for them to sort of burst onto the scene.
Hmm. You know, I was really struck when I was reading your book about the effort that goes into influencing our food preferences, essentially. Is it all an exercise, do you think, in opening up new markets and getting us to spend more of our disposable income on boutique foods? Or is there some kind of conversation that we need to have about whether it's socially responsible, when people are going hungry in this country, to obsess over heirloom wheat or artisanal sausages?
It's a good point. I mean, there's that fundamental question of why should we care about this, right? Why should anyone care about food trend when there are people in the country and in our own communities who are hungry? And I think you need to look at it in another couple of ways, is that, you know, food trends are the innovative edge of the economy, and they touch everyone. It's not just wealthy people who are eating at very fancy restaurants. It's everybody who works down the line of the food industry, which is one of the biggest industries in the country, that employs people from, you know, the six-figure salaries to working wage jobs. And so with each new innovation, with each new trend, you're getting more money that's going into the pockets of those people that will then be able to feed their families. As well, these trends can have the impact of improving the food and the offerings that people who are struggling to feed themselves face. You know, the rise of the past number of years of community gardens, community-supported agriculture, organic farming is in its way its own food trend, right? As the people who are trendy foodies in these different cities pick up on that and talk about the need to, you know, be local and support community gardening, money has flowed in that direction and assisted people in those communities with that.
So do you think that there's a way in which some food trends, maybe particularly the health-oriented food trends, have potential to improve the quality of nutrition that people are getting who maybe don't have huge disposable income?
I think so. I mean, I think these things trickle down. When you think about something like organics a number of years ago was, you know, a very fringe kind of agricultural movement, and you could get organic meat and produce in crunchy smelling health food stores scented like raw almonds and patchouli. Today you can get that stuff at Walmart. You can buy organic produce at Walmart. You can get it at Costco, and it is less expensive because the market for it has grown, and so it becomes accessible to more people. And as more people talk about food, that becomes not just something for wealthy urban foodies. It becomes something that ordinary people talk about as well in their own communities. And so they demand better quality food in school lunches and in college cafeterias and as part of, you know, food stamp programs, where now people are saying, well, let us spend some of that money at CSAs. Why can't we spend our food stamps at CSAs? So I do think fundamentally it's beneficial. I don't think it's a let them eat cake kind of scenario where, you know, people are talking about cronuts and Instagramming it while, you know, the world goes hungry. I don't think it's that much of a either or.
You know, someone told me last year that he thought that food had jumped the shark, that we'd become so precious and obsessed with eating the right things and putting it up on Instagram that we'd essentially forgotten that in the end, it's food, it's nutrition. But you defend these trends. Why do you do that?
Well, listen, in the end, you know, he's partly right, your friend. In the end, it is food, nutrition, and it all ends up, you know, in the same place, to put it delicately. And yet it is tremendously important, I think. You know, food is more than just fuel. It is the way we express our culture. It is the way that we socialize. It is the way that we turn our family recipes and our identities into viable business models that employ thousands of people, whether it's, you know, a product line of snack cakes or whether it is a restaurant chain that somebody starts in their city and then grows nationwide. Food is a tremendous part of our expenditure and our income, you know, anywhere from 10% if you're quite wealthy to 30 to 40 to 50% of your paycheck. And so because it is, and because so much energy is going into it, it is something of tremendous importance. And because of that importance, where we put that money, how we spend it, how we expend our time and treasure and energy in acquiring and cooking and eating food is tremendously important. It says everything about who we are and where we live to what our social and cultural and political values are. You know, how you eat is who you are.
Well, thanks so much, David. I really appreciate your talking with us.
My pleasure, Sarah. Thank you.
David Sachs is the author of The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes, but Fed Up with Fondue. He talked with Sarah Nix.